Okay, this is Cameron and Bob once again. This is session number 39, and we're looking at page 174 into 175 of my pamphlet, and I'm going to do an opening detour and go back up to 150s, 140s to show my transition. So McLuhan ends with basically, for people, the satellite, the effects of the satellite. He then, in the final year, starts talking about computers, and he has a tetrad on the computers. He sees, you know, he's not bad in what he sees coming. But I took it as the computer. He once said there was television, then computer, then satellite. So I took the computer as a stage before the satellite. So I said my innovation was that the effect of the satellite, of the proscenium arch, was to create a hologram. People lived in the hologram, which McLuhan referred to by saying the word makes the market, and largely the word came out of the American presidency. And this would be in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So then I said this hologram, as it got digitized, which means compressed and miniaturized, the hologram would shrink. So I took the idea that the hologram goes through a homeopathic process, which is a word McLuhan used in mid-50s in one of his Renaissance reviews. He talked about Hollywood using homeopathic means, a pretty obscure statement. So I'm seeing the hologram, that was the effect of the satellite, getting tinier and tinier as we get into the increasing power of the digital Android meme. So that's the homeopathic effect on the hologram. So I put together hologram and homeopathy to make holeopathic, which is actually came up with that in the early 90s, I think, when Carol and I were in New York and we were trying to come up with a name for our new company, our medicine company, which would be based on this device that we had. So I came up with Holeopathic Pharmakia. So I had Holeopathic in my mind and applied it in the mid-90s to my chart and the Android meme. So I want to just
don't
show.
Don't you have an essay or something with the word homeopathic in the title?
Yeah, I have. I think it's my essay on McLuhan that I did for Land Straight. McLuhan and homeopathic quadrophenia, is that what it is? Let's see. I go over there and check it out here.
I'm thinking of you wrote something that kind of bounces around between different places, different times, different personalities, has a lot to do with Dartmouth.
That's my diaries. Those are my diaries.
Yeah, but there's...
yes, but no, at that time, I put together the diaries in the 90s. I largely would go back into these events and remember. I had a pretty good memory about what was said. I wasn't writing diaries in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. You know, I didn't think of myself as that significant. But when I came up with this chart, I said, now I'm significant. So, because, you know, at the beginning of the last book of Finnegan's Wake, which is around page 595 or something, 593, it begins with lo, like someone holding up in medieval terms, lo, a magic wand, and behold the chart. Joyce begins with the announcement of a chart in the last book, which becomes the first book in Cycling Back. So anyways, I always think of that Joyce had a chart in his mind. It was significant to come up with a chart. So in the same time, the mid-90s, I wrote McLuhan and Homeopathic Quadrophenia. And that was Well, actually, I wrote it in 98-99 because we did the talk at Fordham, the McLuhan Symposium, done by Lance Strait, and then we had to take what we said and put it into an essay. So I made that. That was where I used the word homeopathic, which I had started to use in my chart in 95. So I applied the chart terms to my essay on McLuhan a few years later, 4 years later. Okay, so I have to go back to find the point I want to make. So let's see. On page 146, let's see if that's 146. Yeah, 146. I say the global membrane, in brackets, Android meme phase 1, see above, was the actual hidden ground of the 1960 to 90 period, not the global theater. And it wasn't noticed until the internet, or information superhighway, was dumped into the brain pan of the super angelic consumer after 1995. Are you there with me?
I'm trying to find it.
Oh, yeah, you're a bit off. So it might be 173 for 145 for you. You'll see the phrase millenary ecstatics, a rare McLuhan term that might stand out as you scan up and down. So the blue part, it's a gray part, gray typeface.
Oh, it's gray.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. The global membrane?
Yeah.
Is that what we're looking for?
Yep. Oh, you can just search it, I guess.
Well, no, but I've got the global membrane, Android meme phase one.
Yes.
Okay. So that's on page 146 for me.
Okay. Was the actual hidden ground of the 60-90 period, not the global theater. And it wasn't noticed until the internet, information superhighway was the first term in the early 90s, was dumped into the brain pan of the super angelic consumer after 1995, which is for most people when the internet came into their lives due to Netscape and Mosaic before that. I think those 93 was Mosaic, and then Netscape provided the environment for most people in 95, 96.
Yeah.
So then I just say McLuhan used the word brain pan in the 60s. Then so the concept of the super angel was probably the most important contribution by McLuhan to the Internet and World Wide Web era. The background to the concept, percept. McLuhan had met Wyndham Lewis in 43 in the Detroit area, and they spent much of their subsequent conversations discussing the concept of the superhuman. These discussions are presented in Lewis's novel Self-Condemned, 1954, wherein one of the discussants is based on McLuhan, in brackets, Professor Ian McKenzie. I knew an Ian McKenzie in Halifax. Guy had the same name. Lewis published two more novels in 95, Monster Gay and Malign Fiesta, parts 2 and 3 of his trilogy, The Human Age, begun in 1928, wherein he explored Hollywood as an environment of discarnate angelic humans, which caused the original astral angels to invade and take over the City of Angels. See third program in The Human Age, Exploration Magazine, number 8, part 2. Now, that's a pretty good obscure McLuhan reference, him talking about.
Yeah.
And that is in part 2 of Verbi Vocal Visual Explorations. You know, he got 24 right. segments that are McLuhan by himself. And then he has a few essays, including himself. And that's the part 2 is where he had third program in the human age, which is an important thing to see. Because he says in that essay that Lewis was the first to use media en bloc, ENBLOC. And most people thought he would be saying Joyce did that. Now, he did emphasize Joyce in the 60s and not Lewis anymore. So that was the 50s. Maybe Lewis was a 50s kind of character. 60s was more Veronian. Okay, Lewis in the 50s is Menippean, and using Don Thiel's terms, Joyce was Veronian, which is a more joyful Menippean satire, Thiel comes up with. Not so whatever you think of the negative vibe around Lewis and his, curmudgeon kind of personality. And there's a biography of him which goes through his life day by day, and it's incredible the shit he got himself into all the time. You know about that? Have you seen anything on him?
Well, no, I'm laughing at your description, but Lewis was famous for basically pissing on everybody that tried to befriend him or help him.
That's right. It's one after another. It's incredible. Right up, I think, did I bring this up, that on his deathbed, his last words were in response to a nurse saying, have you gone to the bathroom or whatever they say? And he says, mind your own business, and dies. Curmudgeon to the end. So I'm saying, see, the angelic... Go ahead.
But that's an interesting thing for Lewis to say, right? I mean, if somebody on their deathbed says the essence of their life, then Lewis can be seen as saying, don't live the life that somebody has pumped into you,
right?
That somebody has pumped around you. Mind your own business.
That's right. It's a very good statement. Super. The services of individualism.
Yeah.
The services. So.
But, you know, Bob, it might be good to not go too fast here.
Yeah.
For example, you started off by contrasting the global membrane with a global theater.
Yeah.
So how do you see those as different?
The global theater has the proscenium arch, as McLuhan defined it. It has a bit of visual space frame, like a theater. And the membrane is a resonating node. And we're all dancing in the same spot, and you can't see or hear that spot.
Okay.
You know, it's not,
so the, you
not
can
a framework.
The global theater is, like artificial scenery in front of the global membrane.
That's right. Yes. And the digitization, the shrinking of the props till you get pure information that everybody's processing, by the 80s, it's truly just an information environment. That's the global membrane and no more theater. Though, no medium I just want to say this, no effect disappears. So the global theater is still as an effect happening by culture lag in different parts of the world. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And so right now, we've reached the point where in Hollywood, there not only is there no scenery anymore, there's no actor.
That's right.
Right? Everything is just a digital representation, basically, of the same.
Yep.
Right, so there's no difference between any of the movies on Netflix or Prime or any of these services. It's just the same portrayed by digital actors in front of digital scenery.
Right, and they keep announcing further development of that. I can't. I saw something the other day. I don't know. Your brain makes the movie or something. You know, they put a chip in you and. It's gotten even more extreme in terms of the nothingness that's involved, or the CGI, or whatever you call it, past CGI. Yeah, it's a what do you call that? What do you call an after image or something worse than after image? It's a ghost.
Mirage maybe.
Mirage, that was the word. Yeah, mirage. So the this is
but
where.
But this means you were talking about the time lag for something to sort of make itself obvious. I mean, you're talking about something that you say happened in, let's say, the 1980s or something. So here we are, almost 40 years later, what happened then is now appearing.
Yes. The figure. He uses the word global membrane in his review of Burroughs in December 64. And I heard a recent interview with Bruce Powell because his latest book is called The Global Membrane. And I didn't know if he knew it. I mentioned it in my little review of his book. But he said in the interview that global membrane came from, and he correctly quotes the 64 review of Burroughs. And he says, I don't think McLuhan ever used the word again. Now, in my mind, there might have been one more time, but I can't think of it. He might be right. Did you recall the word being used more than once?
No, but I'll look it up in a background mode here.
Okay, so the global membrane is the fact in the 60s, in the increasing whatever that world is technologically that we're all inside of. And McLuhan saw that. You know, if I'm describing this resonant node as the internet of the 90s, he saw that in the 50s and 60s. He saw that the television put everybody in this resonant node, but then it gets freed up and more pseudo-mobility to, they call it escape velocity, to escape the resonant node. Virtually through increasing digital rocket ships, or what did he call it? Edible spaceships. You know that phrase?
Uh-huh.
In
yeah.
understanding media? Edible spaceships, which would be pills or drugs. So people could spiral out of the resonant node starting in the 60s through drugs or digital technologies. The Web 1.0 and 2.0, then social media. So I'm saying you got to go past the global theater to get into the implications of what McLuhan was seeing. And you can say, yes, he saw the global membrane and maybe even the Android meme. So I'm going to try to show that he even anticipated the Android meme. So I'm quoting this on page 146, and then the concept of the super angel was probably the most important contribution by McLuhan to the Internet and World Wide Web era. So we were super angels in the global membrane. Then it became figure in the 90s. The background.
And then let me just interrupt and read a couple sentences here. Electric technology favors not the fragmentary, but the integral, not the mechanical, but the organic. It had not occurred to Innes that electricity is, in effect, an extension of the nervous system as a kind of global membrane. That's from the introduction to Bias of Communication.
In 64?
Yeah. Same
year. Year.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that
that's,
was common for McLuhan to... When he got an idea, he would repeat it in different writings at the same time.
Yeah, for about 6 months, you'd get the same stuff in different articles and that. Okay, that's great. So you found that case, and it's probably the earliest, right? Probably doesn't happen before then, but he may have used it in the 70s. That's what I was wondering. Are you able to scan your whole archive?
Well I, yeah, but... I don't see anything. I see only those two from 1964 for global membrane.
That's amazing. I forgot about that or didn't notice it. It's in the, his four.
Well, you sort of knew about it because you mentioned that in regard to Powell that.
No, I know about that. I know about Nation Magazine, December 64. I have no idea. Memory of it being in the Introduction to Bias of Communication, which was reprinted in 64, and McLuhan did the foreword to it, right? That's what you're quoting.
Right.
And
did the intro.
Yeah, which I haven't read that in a long time, but I didn't know Global Membrane was in that.
You said before that you thought there was another mention of the Global Membrane aside from Burroughs.
And I'm thinking of later.
Uh-huh.
Not the same year.
Mm-hmm. You were half right.
Yeah, I was half right. There was another one. It was right next door.
Correct.
Do you have an idea when he wrote the foreword?
When he wrote it?
Yeah, in 64 for the Innes reprint.
No, but oftentimes when McLuhan was asked to write a foreword or an introduction, he would go into his notes and see what he already had
right.
from the past.
Yeah.
And so you never know. If people think that you can date stuff in McLuhan from the date it's published, they're mistaken.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. Many of his writings are sort of compendia of stuff that he had written, had dictated, and then just sort of slammed together when something was needed.
Yeah, and he would artfully add a new wrinkle for only that article. And then the next article, you might find another. There'd be the general repeat of his themes, but then there'd be some new little twist or wrinkle or nuance, and they would be only in that article. You'd never see him say that thing again. And then there'd be another wrinkle in the next article from different.
But right, and that's more or less what he called thinking. So the this process of writing that we're talking about is analogous to McLuhan's fondness for talking, because in both cases, you're basically saying stuff that everybody already knows, but something can click in the process of doing it.
Yeah.
And so McLuhan wrote as a kind of conversation with himself.
Yeah, did you say painting? I
no,
thought you said he was painting. I don't know what you said then.
Thinking.
Thinking. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
It was his thinking, yes.
Yeah, it was his process.
Yeah. Maybe he was the first thinking out loud guy. He said, I don't know what I think until I say it. And nobody really
Correct.
Said that before, I don't think. But in an information interviewing world of, radio and TV conversational thing going on, his thinking was the appropriate style for that period, the appropriate art for that medium,
right.
for that era.
And now again, it's appearing to everybody as something obvious that was going on with him. This is 60 years ago.
Yeah.
And that is that everybody's locked in a bubble, and these bubbles are sort of bouncing off each other, but there's no communication going on. And one of the problems that McLuhan had was that people often got the sense that he wasn't talking to them, he was talking to himself.
Yeah,
and,
I saw that.
So then people would get their back up and would react against that.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't be able to hear what was actually going on with him.
That's right. There was probably never a man who said the same thing so many times in the world of ideas. I once in 74 dropped into his office in July. And he was lecturing Barry Nevitt. They were working on a shortened version of Take Today. And I was down there listening to them for about 20 minutes. And McLuhan was saying the same stuff he said 30 years before or, 15 years before. He was defining visual space and acoustic space for the 10th millionth time to Barry Nevitt, who, of course, had heard it 100,000 times. It's like McLuhan... It was his vision. What he was seeing, what he was trying to describe, was so tasty to him. It wasn't a problem to keep eating it again by talking it,
Right. But it wasn't only a question of being tasty, although I agree with you on that. I think it's a nice phrase.
Yeah.
But it was also he was hammering away at something that was there, and he couldn't find it.
Yeah. And it was hard to find.
So,
very hard to find.
Yeah, of course. I'm not saying it's easy.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that anybody has found it yet. But I'm saying that that was, you know, you see these cartoons of Einstein with a million formulas on the blackboard.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was what McLuhan was doing. He had two or three sort of master problems, and he was hammering away at them, trying to figure out how to get them to go into an equation.
Into the Limoges juice.
He
was looking for the Limoges juice.
Yeah.
Motjuste.
Yeah.
The right word. I'm prompted to say that people would get stimulated by this process, this hammering, and they would get ideas from it, and they thought they understood them. And they'd walk away with their subjective grabbing of what they thought he was doing.
Right.
And so he was the great communicator, or he was the non-great communicator. But some people would be puzzled, but it was amazing how much that process of drilling and repetition inspired people. What he said probably was so broad that people fell into it, fell into the rabbit hole of the idea, and then found ways to get their way out of it, and that was new thinking for them. You get me?
I guess so.
They fall into the hole of his vision. I mean, they can't see what the level he's seeing it. They don't think that big.
No, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But I just I react against the idea that there were too many people that this applied to. Probably in the whole world, there were 20 people who were inspired by McLuhan in the sense you're talking about.
Don't mean in a deep way. I mean people would
listen,
say
it wasn't so deep. It wasn't so deep. Those 20 people didn't understand what he was talking about.
I know, but I'm saying
they were the only ones that were.
Yeah, I say the others in the audience, whether in the seminars, were intrigued by what he thought, and they were stimulated and got images from it.
That was like them eating cereal in the morning or something.
That was intellectual life. You know, they'd walk out of the seminar quite satisfied. They had a good meal, and what a guy! You know, he really got me thinking things I hadn't thought.
But there were people all over campus doing the same thing with some guy that was talking about the poetry of whoever, and another guy was talking about the evolution of life, and another guy was talking about new discoveries in chemistry or something. So that's, you know. That's
yeah, but he was different because he talked about people's present, not a subject. Not chemistry. He was.
But you see, Bob, I don't think for 99% of people that were listening to McLuhan, I think that they didn't understand anything about present, past, future. I think they just.
They treated him as just another professor. Yes, they didn't understand
it. I think
so. They didn't understand the uniqueness of them. But there were a few people who were stimulated in that sense and weren't profound.
I agree with that. Yeah. I agree with that. But it's just it's a relative handful. And the only thing that would have been real communication by McLuhan would have been to hand on his problems, to hand on the idea that not only is there something there to be learned, but we can learn it.
Right.
And I see myself doing that. I see you doing that in some senses.
Yeah.
But I don't see the quote-unquote McLuhan scholars of all of the different stripes. I don't see them doing that.
No, I agree.
And it's, yeah.
But now, who can you name 5 or 10 people who you felt might have gotten it, or we never knew them? We never heard from them.
In terms of McLuhan?
Yeah. Who are the people, the 20 people that got it, so to speak?
Well, I'm thinking, I'm not saying that they actually got it. I say that they were inspired, people like Thompson, let's say, that were inspired to go on to stuff that is interesting, but they were not necessarily inspired in the way that McLuhan was trying to sort of hand over this problem we were just discussing, this hammering away stuff.
Right.
So
and you mean by Thompson, William Irwin Thompson?
Yeah. And what's the name of the guy who was at University of New Brunswick? Maybe he's still there. The guy that does McLuhan and Pound. And then there's the guy in Toronto or Windsor or London who does McLuhan and sort of esoteric stuff.
Leon Tourette?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
who's the guy in New Brunswick? Who are you thinking of in New Brunswick?
The Greek guy. Tyrannopoulos or something?
I don't know about that. I think I know his mentor, who I don't have his name right now. I remember he would be a younger guy, this Andropoulos name. Yes, I think I know who you mean.
So all of these people took interesting aspects of McLuhan. They took things that he had turned up through his mental activity and that were fertile.
Yeah.
And they took them, a lot further than he did. But did they understand the essence of the problem that he was trying to get at? I don't think so. I think Innes, Innes, before he died, Innes starting in maybe 1947 or something like this, he understood. Innes and McLuhan had very good dialogue, I believe.
Mm. Did you ever hear my interview with Leon Tourette?
No.
Oh, you got to hear that. You go to
I'd be interested in that.
Yeah, you go to Dobstown.com, it's a small page, and in the middle it says wiretaps, the middle column, and there's a whole vertical list of names. So just scroll down till you get to Leon Tourette. Now, he was a student of McLuhan's in 62 in that, right when McLuhan sort of started to get noticed. And so Leon and his friends in the class, McLuhan was normal for them. And they were shocked to see that the world thought it was significant what he was saying. And then he started to get into the media. He said it was quite weird for them because they didn't see McLuhan on that level, maybe because they were too young and they weren't getting it. But anyways, in the interview, at some point near the end, I say what I think McLuhan meant, okay? I couldn't say what it was, but I thought I was defining some basic McLuhan. He says, "Where'd you get that idea?"
Yeah.
I said, "That's McLuhan." He says, "I've never heard of that. That's ridiculous. Hey, what, you're crazy." Yeah. So I thought, holy cow.
Yeah.
But he did.
Let me make sure I understand what you were saying in terms of the reference. You said, did you say Dobstown.net?
Oh, no, Dobbs, D-O-B-B-S, Dobbs.
Yeah.
Dobstown.com.
Yeah. Oh, .com, okay.
Yeah.
I've never been there, so I'll have to take a look.
Yeah.
And then you said the interview is under wiretap, is that right?
Yeah, there's a middle column. There's my stuff on the left and right, different aspects, and then there's down a bit. Near the top, it says wiretaps. You can look at it right now if you're on there, and just you'll see a row, a vertical row of many names, and those are all my interviews with interesting people. But Tourette's an example of someone who gets McLuhan's issue or something, and is not repeating McLuhan, he's applying it to his own studies of Pound and the esoteric occult stuff that he was interested in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So you have a kind of a panorama is opened, and McLuhan was mostly interested just in opening it, takes a quick sniff, and decides that that's not going to lead him where he wants to go.
Yeah.
But somebody else looks at this panorama and they say, holy smokes, there's a whole continent there to be explored.
Yeah. It's funny you bring up this Greek name. I know who you mean, but I discovered him. Is he actually given credit in Leon's books?
Oh, sure.
Right. That's where I've seen it. Yeah. But yeah, I know his mentor, who is really good on Pound, and an older guy, I guess his professor. So, but I had noticed this Greek name associated with him, or Surrett, both of them, and that's the first time anybody ever brought him up. You brought him up, but I kind of knew. When you said New Brunswick, I was thinking of that guy, but I didn't have his name. Then you said it, and I said, yeah, that's the guy. So very good there. You're into the nooks and crannies of Dobbstown. We've taken you. You've come into certain hidden crevices of my reality, my landscape of McLuhan. Yeah. There's okay. So these discussions. Okay, we're talking about the super angel, the background to the concept percept, the background to the super angel concept slash percept. McLuhan had met Wyndham Lewis in 43 in the Detroit area, and they spent much of their subsequent conversation discussing the concept of the superhuman. That's the term in the novel, Self-Condemned, which is based on Lewis's encounter with McLuhan, McLuhan being the character Professor Ian McKenzie. And I have here, go to page 312 if you're listening, if you have the book Self-Condemned. McKenzie's introduced on page 312. So then I say we did the astral angels. So then I say conversationally, just as the angels were outraged that humans developed language, this is a replay of that occasion with a later kind of language movies. That irritated the angels, the same conflict. Then back to my more formal prose, from superhuman to super angel. McLuhan pointed out in the 70s that an angel could be anywhere, but only there before moving on to another there in a sequential manner. Eventually, the angel would or could experience everywhere. However, the human engaging electronic services of the global membrane, what McLuhan termed the discarnate condition, could be everywhere simultaneously and immediately, no sequentiality involved. Imagine that you were broadcasting on the radio to 500,000 people. Each one of those private listener environments would have a piece of you in them via the radio. And each one of the 500,000 listeners would have a piece occupying your studio, passively present in your, they would be passively present in your environment. Then once telephones for live call-ins were added, everybody could potentially be actively in every other listener's home, the condition presented on every page of Finnegan's Wake. Hear calls everywhere. James Joyce, Finnegan's Wake, page 108. No angel could do this, but the human cum super angel did. This capacity would result in a completely different consequence from that of the old superhuman. McLuhan had upgraded Lewis's insights. And then, well, I'll just say, in my then my conversational blue-tinted print says, I go, the superhuman is the conceptual content of Self-Condemned. The guest professor, René Harding, who's based on Wyndham Lewis, is interacting at the university with Professor Ian McKenzie, who's based on Marshall McLuhan. They're discussing Nietzsche's Superman or superhuman. They're arguing over the super-Gnosticism of the 20s and 30s symbolized by people like Nietzsche and Adolf Hitler. That's the superhuman. But Lewis discovered the angelic competitors of the superhuman. McLuhan later refined what it meant, as explained above. Once in the Internet World Wide Web surrounds, the super angel became her own intelligence agency. This is precisely the meaning of the vague phrase, the post-human. McLuhan got there first in his nomenclature. And I say, it's not post-human, it's a super angelic happening. But all this background...
Maybe you should say something about sort of what you think is going on here, and why you thought it was necessary to come back here from where we were on 174, 175.
Because I want to show the post McLuhan, but saying McLuhan implied, intuited, actually maybe meant it. I'm coming up to the verbal module and the theme of meme. All right, which not coined until 1976 by Richard Dawkins in the Selfish Gene book he did, but McLuhan's onto the meme. So I don't know. I may not have to do much of this. So I'm going to jump forward to where I'm going, a verbal module. But I'm just doing this because we haven't done much content, and I think this is the book pamphlet. This is a key point: the super angelic. You know what I mean? And that the extended human is a greater extension than the angelic. See, to say we're angels is not the point.
I can relate to that. But how is this different from or going beyond or contrasted to the android meme?
Okay, well, I think I'm going to try to get there. I'm trusting. I haven't read this in a long time, but I think I go step by step. So let's see if I can back that statement up. So I go, but all this background exegesis is the preparation for the far more difficult and strange situation of a tech body. So I'm getting to the tech body, but now I've got to go into the android meme first before we get to the tech body. So I'm going from the super angelic and the global membrane to the android meme. So these are post-McLuhan stages. Well, he never got to spell it out.
So is a super angelic before, you know, I hate this linearity.
Yeah, I know.
But for you, it's the super angelic is before the android meme?
No, it is the android meme, but you got to go through the popularizing of angel that McLuhan did and people thought, and they didn't know he was talking about the super angel. You'd have to read Take Today or something to see this distinction. And so I'm trying to change people's perception because visual space is angelic. He even spells that out in Power's book, The Global Village. I don't know how much Powers got it from McLuhan, but it said there the difference between the angelic and the robotic. I don't even know if Powers gets to the super angelic the way I'm defining it. But this, it's a way of describing the global membrane. We're all in this place that has incredible dimensions, not visual space dimensions.
I think that's right. So that problematizes use of the word in.
Which word?
You can't say we're in.
Right. No, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe we're in, you know, the usual place if I got to use words to talk to you. But,
right. That's my best alibi. I use it all the time.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I am going rearview mirror trying to explain the cul-de-sac.
Right.
You know, so what
right.
the hell? Apparently people get something out of it. So I'm just trying to contribute to the community, okay? Be useful. Remember, McLuhan once said that Moses, you know, looked around. Was it Moses? Pretty sure it was Moses. He had the dilemma of making himself useful to the Pharaoh. I like that. McLuhan, after World War II, or when would that be? Yeah, in 39-40 when he graduated, got his PhD, he then had to make himself useful, right? He had to find a role. So I always thought that was funny. You know, you're up against the Pharaoh. And in the Burroughs article, he talks about the pharaonic Egyptian nature of the 20th century. It's been retrieved by the electronic. So I'm not going far from
that. He was very much influenced by Joyce in that.
Yeah.
Right. He was conscious of Joyce continually bringing up Egypt and the pharaonic and all this stuff in the Finnegan's Wake.
That's right. Okay. And I have a quote here. This is by Croker. Listen to this quote from a 2012 book, Body Drift, and I'm thinking of my five bodies, so I welcome that title, and then it's a commentary on, I guess, feminist postmoderns, Butler, Hales, and Haraway. So look what he says. He says...
Well, before we look at what he says here, just remember what I said earlier about you reading tons and tons of stuff, but not reading the gold that's out there.
I know you don't think much of Croker, but I differ on the Croker.
No, I'm not trying to put Croker down. I'm trying to say that you were saying that you don't spend time on all of these characters, that you're reading Finnegan's Wake and all this sort of stuff. And I'm saying, well, you know, it does seem that you're reading these people.
No, I'm reading Croker, and I put Croker in my chart. Croker is great. He's not in the class of de Kirchhoff and Logan and Kuskis and these people.
No, not even close. Not even close.
Right. So this is a good quote.
He's one of these guys that we could have, when we were identifying Thompson and Surratt, the guy in New Brunswick.
Yeah.
Croker belongs with them.
Yeah.
McLuhan opened up his world, and then basically he had to explore the fragments that were left.
That's right. So look at this quote. I think it continues. It starts off circuited by all the flows of power. Then it goes down, nothing, you know, and I have the body drift. I think... Why wouldn't I have a source if it was different after the quote I'm going to read? But I'm assuming it comes from the same book. Okay. Croker says, describing the body. Here's the body. It's circuited by all the flows of power, patterned by code works, shaped by norms of cultural intelligibility, an object of viral invasion, with its subjectivity increasingly taking the form of possessed individualism. All that is the opening clause describing the body. And with that in mind, he says, the body can acquire such a powerful epistemological presence as a universal sign because the bodies that we are or would like to become are themselves increasingly dispersed, intermediated, unfinished, spliced, and straining. Then he says, it's going down to 149, nothing
right.
is as a
but
mag-
Let me just okay. interject that... What Croker is saying there is more or less what McLuhan says when he talks about the end of private identity.
Yeah. But it's also physical, as you'll see the next sentence. Nothing
right.
Nothing is as imaginary as the material body.
Correct.
That's more than your literate private identity. That's more physical.
Well, okay. I mean,
I think
that McLuhan certainly wasn't, in my reading, McLuhan wasn't limiting his thoughts about private identity to some sort of literary
label,
signature or style or something.
Yeah.
I think he was thinking of the functioning human being with his job. You know, he talks about, I'm a dentist, I'm 43, and all this stuff. It's
right.
funny. So, you know, that's not
yes, but that's
forgetting
why
the material.
I agree with you, and that's why I pick out quotes. McLuhan didn't write it out like this. This gets into people's images.
All he did was take a smell and say, well, that's not where I need to go.
Right. Well, Croker is describing the devastating disappearance of people's private identity in terms that are shocking. They're not going to think of it as their material body. But McLuhan meant that, and Croker is spelling it out. So that's why he's valuable.
Correct.
So he says
the single most interesting thing about McLuhan is that he saw what Croker was talking about here, but thought it was entirely possible to be Catholic at the same time. Or you could put it, he saw what Croker was talking about here and saw it as entirely possible to be the father of six kids.
Yeah.
So it's the...
That probably, Croker never got past that confusion or problem for him. It's the same as Neil. They thought McLuhan was schizoid.
Correct. So they, just as we've been talking earlier in our conversation, panorama gets opened, and Croker goes out and explores it. And his exploration is very interesting, very well said, but that's not the nub of things. This is a little bit like what we were talking about before with, I want to say Baudelaire, but it's not Baudelaire. Who's the Baudrillard?
Yeah.
What Croker is trying to do is he's trying to come to terms with the cul-de-sac. And so he is describing sometimes in minute detail the lacerations, the opacities, the felt discouragement. He's describing all these sorts of things in an attempt to get away from them or to get out of them or to find a way out of the cul-de-sac. Well, I'm not so sure that he did find a way.
No, I understand.
But that doesn't make it uninteresting. It just puts it in a certain place in comparison to McLuhan. That's all it does.
Yeah. Okay, so let me give you this elaborate post-imaginary body. He says, nothing is as, I just moved it, nothing is as imaginary as a material body. So he then describes the body, circulating, fluid, borderless, with no certain boundaries or predetermined history. The body has no meaning today other than its intermediations. There's no meaning today other than its intermediations, no autobiography that does not possess its own ontologies. I think ontology is a word from Derrida. And certainly no drift that does not leave a trace of its presence. There definitely are codes of gender that can be transgressed only at the price of punishment, but there are always gender drifters who remix, recombine, and resplice the codes of gender performance. There certainly is a disciplinary regime of sexuality, but there are also sex code drifters who make of their own sexual assignment an opportunity to transgress the codes, to refuse the normative, to overcome the predetermined. Against class inequities burned into disciplined laboring bodies, there are class drifters who make of their own protesting, rebelling, insurgent bodies a marker of the struggle for freedom. While the age of specialization resulted in the definitive separation of the senses, body drift begins with a grand unification of the human sensorium. Now, that's quite a mouthful, and he's scanning as a sociologist across the society and picking up symptoms that are very prominent today. This was written in, he writes partly this kind of stuff in the 90s, but this is a later replay, 2012, by them. We've got these people running around. They're major figures today, these sex code drifters. What else do we call them? Gender drifters. That's just a good phrase, gender drifters. So I find it a kind of great sociological poetry, what he does. That's, when I'm reading junk. Sorry. Occasionally I slip into it. a woman I knew in Toronto, she read my book, Fatty Communion, and the McLuhan quote, she says, it's amazing how clear he is. And I was laying out the quotes in a good order so you could learn from them or get McLuhan. But that was a good observation. McLuhan was not your wordy Norman Mailer or Thomas Pynchon with flowery Baroque spirals all over the place. He just stated simply, like clear glass of water, what the ground was or what we were experiencing. And this person noticed that, said she thought she wouldn't understand him, but then she read him and said, wow, he's so clear. Croker probably is not clear for that person if she ever read this, you know? Too many words.
Yeah, I think that's right. But the, McLuhan usually wasn't writing because he was attempting to be clear.
No.
He was writing to try to get somewhere that he didn't know.
Right. And
that he just sensed was out there.
Right. And that woman's response is what I was saying earlier. Totally not getting McLuhan the way McLuhan was or what he was dealing with, but thinking he was clearing things up for her. There's the
right.
Paradox.
Well, but there's also the point that by putting McLuhan in order, which you did in that book, was a way of showing that there was a kind of order there that McLuhan himself wasn't paying much attention to, but somebody like you could find it and stick
replay
it in a book.
It. Yeah.
But
that required years of getting to know his stuff and realizing in stages that I didn't get him, you know, kept correcting my perception of him.
Right. Yeah, I'm interested in that process, Claude. Sometimes you've mentioned a couple times I think you said once that in the 70s you came to understand that you had understood McLuhan in a more or less Gutenbergian way.
Yeah.
And you had to break with that. And the whole idea of people thinking against themselves is something that's very important for anybody that wants to understand McLuhan for sure.
Right. It helped moving to Toronto and hanging out with McLuhan. That really helped to realize that it was way different from what I thought the books were telling me, you know. Now, later, I then could go back to books and see the McLuhan that I had discovered in person. But I wanted to say, I can go back and remember reading Understanding Media in the mid-60s, and it's so blurred in my memory that I was hallucinating on the book. I was projecting wildly what I thought I wanted or what I thought should be or some ridiculous users of content.
Right.
I had no clue what he was talking about, but I thought I was learning something and getting it. And I would try to explain to people, and they wouldn't know what the hell I was talking about, and I didn't know what I was talking about.
But I thought I did.
But
you're talking there for every man.
Yeah.
That's true of me.
Yeah.
When I first encountered McLuhan in the 60s, you know, I got all of his books were then available and read them and thought that I understood most of it. And I didn't understand anything, basically.
Yeah. And what was I going to say? I would keep going back and looking at the books. Since I was traveling a lot, we moved a lot, I didn't have much of a library to take with me, but I had some basic McLuhan books that came with me all the time. And I'd go back and look at a book, you know, after not looking at it for, like, Culture's Our Business, for having looked at it for 2 years, and I started looking at it. Holy shit, I don't recognize any of this stuff. This is all incredible. This is amazing. Look what's in this book, you know? And I'd keep re-delighting myself with discovery, and I didn't bother buying other books. I could just work with the McLuhan, jump from book to book, and it'd always be new. I didn't understand why other people didn't get that. Most people read a little, thought they got it, moved on, and then they create the lousy world we have today because they didn't read it enough, so to speak.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But what you're saying, I think, is that the key to McLuhan are certain problems that can be thought about forever.
Yeah.
And there isn't any getting to the bottom of them. They're limitless in their implication. And what McLuhan would have us do is understand something about the nature of those problems and the confidence it takes to engage them.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. What was I thinking? Because I studied the occult also in the 50s and 60s, I didn't know it, but that was what McLuhan was working with. And I used to think that McLuhan was explaining the occult, but he didn't know it because I didn't know his background yet. I hadn't read Interior Landscape, I don't think. And so I thought I was making the wow, this is gives me words to clarify what the occult was talking about, because the occult I studied talked about the stages of apprehension and the seven levels of development of the senses and then beyond the senses. So what a discovery it was to find out when I got to Interior Landscape, wow, he's talking about the occult stuff. And then I found out from Theo that that's what they did. So that it's a marvel getting to understand someone who is pretty profound, so there's a lot to understand about the person. It's going to take a while, you know, or to find out what he's dealing with. So he was a good guy to study, I found. Mm-hmm. He had lots to find.
I mean, of course, I agree completely.
Yeah.
That's
you're still
why we're
doing
talking,
it.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I'm reading Finnegan's Wake, I'm reading McLuhan, you know, or vice versa. So...
Uh-huh.
I used to drive the Finney's Wake people in New York in the Finney's Wake Society crazy. I kept mentioning McLuhan on this and that. They didn't. Who the hell? Will you shut up? I don't want to hear about this McLuhan guy. We're doing James Joyce. It was funny.
Yeah. That's the story of your life, Bob.
That's right. Yeah, I went on the radio, outraged Toronto people. Why are you mentioning this guy? Okay, so...
Tell me, just while it's on my mind here, how many copies of Finnegan's Wake did McLuhan work with?
He had four. I copied three of them, and then there was a small, the old paperback, and there wasn't much in it, not much annotation. So basically it was three, but there was four.
And you have those?
Yes. I Nelson one weekend. This really pissed off Eric because he was helping her and I was in the background helping Nelson, and Mary was around and she knew what we were doing for her mother, who was trying to get the McLuhan program at the U of T removed from the U of T. She didn't like what Derek was doing with it, and Derek had not hired Eric or used Eric in any way. She didn't like that. But Eric wasn't around so much, so Nelson did all the work and lobbying. So one weekend, he was at her home, and he saw the three Finnegan's Wakes, you know, piled up. And he asked, could I borrow these? And she's, yeah, take them for the weekend. Or I don't think she said, oh, you would look at this. You should look at these. I think he noticed them. So this Friday afternoon, and I'm home, I get a knock on the door, and there's Nelson with these three books, three piled up big books. And he says, here, Bob, Xerox them, and I need them Monday morning. I said, okay. And then I started to look and begin to intuit what the hell I was holding. It's like someone handed me $1 billion worth of gold, for fuck's sake. I said, holy cow. So immediately Nelson took off. You know, he had a family. He had to get home. So I went around the corner to the Xerox guy, who I'd done a lot of Xeroxing, and I said, I'm going to be here all weekend. Can you help me? And he said, sure. So I Xeroxed it all for 3 days, Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday, all day Sunday, and maybe even a bit on Monday. So it was incredible doing that.
And you have all those copies, right?
Yeah, all those pages, and I had to make extra copies for Nelson. He also had the Bias of Communication and the Skeleton Key. And he said, here, Bob, you take the Skeleton Key, I'll take the Bias of Communication. But I Xeroxed the Bias of Communication and the annotations and gave it back to Nelson. And when we found out years later that Eric was outraged, he found out somehow that weekend the books weren't there. Where are they? Oh, I lent them to Nelson, and he was outraged about that. But he didn't have a case. He liked to say later we stole them or something stupid. He didn't have a case, no. Nelson had done a lot for Mrs. McClellan, and that was her award or payment for it, you know what I mean, or appreciation. So I lucked out by being part of it. And
so I thought earlier you said that he had just been lent the books. He was actually given the books?
As far as I understand, he could keep the Bias of Communication, and I could keep the Skeleton Key.
Uh-huh. And copies of the Wake?
Oh, no, we had to return those books on Monday.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, okay. But I think
him to Corinne.
Yes, Nelson came by Monday noon hour or something. I gave them to him, really thanked him for it. And then he came back later, and I gave him copies of stuff for him. I had to make him some copies. He wasn't that interested in the Finney's Wake. He didn't want all that. But I had to give him a copy of Skeleton Key. And, you know, right now, I think I have Skeleton Key upstairs in the safe. The book, pretty sure. But I haven't looked at it in a long time. But I have a Xerox of the Bias of Communication, and I gave it back to Nelson. I assume he still has it. And I know that Eric would have been outraged when he discovered that they didn't have the Bias Communication anymore. I don't know if he discussed it with his mother, but he later told people that we stole stuff, and that wasn't true. So it's not, you know, if he wants to make a case out of it, or anybody else in the family, I don't think they're going to get very far with it. I probably would give, if they made a big problem out of it, I'd give him back the Skeleton Key, because I've got the Xerox, and it's kind of minor. The Xeroxing of the Finnegan's Wake with all that annotation is what's important. And I've got a Xerox of the Bias of Communication annotation, so I don't need the books.
Yeah. And the book is obsolete.
Yeah. Yeah, completely.
So I'm thinking with the different versions, are different books of annotations. Those thought together amount to McLuhan's commentary on the Wake, right?
Yeah, they are the commentary. Yep.
Yeah. So shouldn't those comments be transcribed and aggregated?
I think it's happening. I understand that Logan has students, and they go into the Fisher Rare Book Library, and they're copying down, annotating or whatever, all the annotations of all the books going through the library. Now, Finnegan's Wake is in there. You know, they can get access to those books and copy them out.
And this, and all of the copies of the three copies of Finnegan's Wake are there.
They should be, because we didn't keep them.
Uh-huh.
Now, Eric may have them. Now, what happened when Eric moved out of Toronto to Bloomfield, you know, Leopold Bloom of Ulysses, I think it was called Bloomfield, out near Trenton, his house caught on fire.
Correct.
And he lost stuff, got burnt.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Right.
You'd heard of that, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know
that
what he lost.
In the middle 90s. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe the Finney's Wake. I saw them. I saw one or something. See, I went to the Ford book, and then the special part is called the Tom
Fisher.
the Fisher Rare Book Library or something. I went in there and looked at the McLuhan inventory and Xeroxed a couple things, but I noticed Spinning His Wake was in there, at least one copy. Don't know if I saw more than one. Not much sticks in my head about it, so it couldn't have been a problem. If I had noticed there was only one, and where were the other two, I would have remembered that. But I have no memory, so I think it was okay. They had the three. You know, it would just flow over my memory. It wouldn't be a big issue to remember. It wouldn't be a mistake, so to speak. So because I don't have any aggravated thought about it, I think they had all three. So I think that's I think that's great what Logan's doing, if he's doing it, is going through.
Yeah, if he's doing it, and if they are doing it competently, then that would be great.
Yeah.
I think that I think the extent of McLuhan's comments on the wake, taken over the three volumes, would be quite surprising to people.
Yeah. You know, what I noticed in Skeleton Key, which was sparsely annotated compared to the Finnegan's Wake volumes, is that he has a note at the beginning. He says, Campbell misses the role of the prank queen, which was, for McLuhan, the phonetic alphabet, and, of course, the effects of the alphabet. You know, Campbell and them didn't get that. And that's the main statement at the beginning of the book. That's like his summation. He misses the role of the prank queen, which is a very good thing to know that McLuhan thought that about the prank queen, because, you know, it's an important story in Finnegan's Wake and a mystery for a lot of people. And to find the sentence where he defines what he thinks it means is a great find. And I met Campbell in 79. There was a conference at the University of Toronto. Bucky Fuller was invited, McLuhan was invited, Campbell and a lot of people. And I tried to talk to Campbell about McLuhan. I didn't know, I didn't know about Skeleton Key and McLuhan's copy yet. And he was very irritated. He wouldn't talk about McLuhan. And so it didn't go anywhere. He definitely didn't want to talk about it. Years later, maybe in the Skeleton Key was a letter by Eric to Campbell, or Campbell to Eric. Can't remember right now. I think I have it.
Yeah, I've seen that actually.
Yeah, where Eric
is, I forgot where, but
yeah, was trying to open a dialogue with Campbell. Basically infiltrate him and then propagate him and get him to wake up. You know, it was the McLuhan agenda. But it was an opener, and I don't think Campbell responded to it.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that. It seemed to me that it was sort of overly praising Campbell.
Yeah, it was.
That's the remote memory I have of that.
Right, and it wasn't sincere. It was an attempt to infiltrate. I call it infiltrate the guy, then tell him stuff that he would be surprised at, and then that was shown. Okay, that's 1979. You know, 11 years later, 1990 or so, I'm getting the text where he says, way back in the 60s, probably, that Campbell missed the prank queen. And I'm sure Eric saw that, knew that. So, and so what happened, Campbell becomes what people wanted McLuhan to become, a talking head with a big series and, you know, great stuff for people that think they're learning something. And he became a bigger hit than McLuhan with that Bill Moyer series in the late 80s.
Yeah.
And
everything you ever wanted to know about everything.
Yeah, and you know, I met the guy here, friend of Mary McLuhan, David Greenberg, who in the late 70s proposed to do that, to make a TV series with McLuhan, because he could do it. He was in LA, he has a rich kid, he knew all the artists and scene makers, and he had access to the TV thing. He said it'd be no problem for him to do you know, like Kenneth Clark's Civilization, or what's that guy, Bernowski's The Ascent of Man, those kind of series in the 70s. They would do, you know, a 10-thing series on with McLuhan talking it. And McLuhan was getting ready to go to L.A. to do it, and he had a stroke. And David, who I met in 2008 when I came here to Maui, because Mary said, look him up. He lives in Maui, and he's got stuff to tell you. So he's the guy, the missing guy at the end of the McLuhan biography that Marshawn and Gordon didn't know about. Because he's going to do McLuhan. McLuhan's getting ready to move to L.A. to do it. And then on September 26th, he collapses, and that's the end. And when I met Greenberg later, he said he was in Brazil at that time. It took him about 6 months to find out that McLuhan wasn't available anymore. It took, you know, he was out of touch for that period. So that was a shocker. I think he read about it in the paper or something. And because it took many months before the McLuhan family even revealed what was going on with McLuhan. We were all told to don't say a word to anybody, you know. I have a letter by Logan written on the day McLuhan died. So that's December 31st, 1980. And Logan's writing to somebody who's inquiring about McLuhan and, you know, when can we see him? What's going to happen? And Logan's saying, oh, he's great. He'll be probably back in public functioning in a few month or two. Incredibly optimistic or lying. I don't know. McLuhan was functioning, you know. He could have functioned like that, it seemed. You wouldn't get that from Logan's letter. And then McLuhan died, I noted, later that day at nighttime.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of obfuscation about what was really happening to McLuhan and by the family.
Mm.
Which they had the right to do that. They didn't want people, you know, nosing around.
Well, I mean, at that time, people were talking about shutting down the coach house, right?
It had been shut down. It was shut down in June.
Of 80?
Yep. That was the end. I have the letters by Mark Stewart about the chaos that the center had gone through because of Elner Austin. And Marg complains about Eric and someone else there that they weren't fucking dealing with the problem. See, Marshall took her down to the coach house like about April. And, you know, it's written up in Marshawn's book because she might have sent some of her notes to him. They're looking at the mess, and McLuhan's in real shock, and she's in shock, and McLuhan starts crying. And so she made a diary of dealing with this problem for the next 6 weeks. So I have her inventory of what she did the next day, who she wrote to, who she got in touch with. I mean, she wanted to fix it up, and she could hardly walk with her broken hip. So it was a pretty futile thing. And then it closed down in June. That was the end of June. And then it was a closed center for until early 81. McLuhan dies in, 6 months later. I don't think anything was going on through most of 81, but by the fall of 81, we were meeting somewhere, like Derek and Logan and Eric would find some place and try to keep the McLuhan Monday night things going. And there was a big conference of the McLuhan guys, like Zingroni from York, and from Ryerson and from other people. Everybody was there. Even William Irvin Thompson was there. He happened to be in town. And me and my friend Ian Arlott were there, and everybody was jockeying and trying to figure out who was going to take over the mantle and how to do it. So everybody, like a typical academic scene, everybody's all friendly and say, yeah, we'll do this and that, and I'll cooperate. Nothing happened. Completely nothing.
Yeah.
Nobody did anything. Nobody wanted to do anything except Derek. And so in 82, because because that was the fall of 81. And then by 82, Derek started to continue the seminars by himself. And me, I hadn't met Nelson yet, me and a couple other obscure people were the only ones going to it. And I have the notes that Derek would write up the topic. He'd bring in guests. And I have the notes from that 82 period. And then in the spring of 83 or early February, March 83, David Olson was made the – they finally got the Cochos back open. And David Olson was made the director, and Derek was the assistant director. So by May 83, Nelson and I and Barry are doing the McLuhan fanfares. But Zingroni wasn't there. The Ryerson guys weren't there. Eric wasn't there. Nobody was doing it. We were doing it. You know, the people. The leftover peasants were doing it. And plus Derek, who was a professor in the French department. So it got more formal, and Olson through 83 brought people in. And I've got copies of the reports that Olson did for each meeting. And I hung out. So then we asked, me and Nelson and Barry asked Derek if we could do the McLuhan thing starting in the middle of May. I just met Nelson in April. George Thompson introduced me to him at a McLuhan thing. If you look at my pictures, I have on my Ina Bob at the bottom, 40 years in the wilderness. And you can go through, I have pictures from 1969-70 all the way through to 2013, but if you go to 1984, it's all linear, you can see pictures of a conference in about April or the end of March in the Coach House in 84, and you'll recognize a lot of the faces there. So I have pictures of that in my own photo biography. But so meanwhile, we get into 84, we're doing it with Barry. And then Nelson, he joins the Herbert W. Armstrong religious cult. The world, they used to be on, Garner Ted Armstrong used to be on the radio, and his father ran it.
Who was that?
Nelson. Nelson, he was Jewish, and he converted to Catholicism under McLuhan's influence in the late 70s. And then he had another identity crisis in the early 80s, and after McLuhan died, and so he went into Herbert Armstrong. And those guys say the Vatican is part of the beast. So when he saw Derek on TV, when the Pope, you know, the traveling Pope, with John Paul I, when
John
he
Paul
came through,
second.
Or yeah, the second, I guess, yeah. When he, you know, the guy who traveled for years got it out there. He came through Toronto in you know, March or April 84, and Nelson saw him on TV. Derek was the guy explaining the Pope to the CBC crew, and Nelson was shocked that Derek was working for the Antichrist, so he refused to do the fucking seminar anymore. He wouldn't go to the Coach House. He dumped it all. And so that's right when me and Bob Marshall were starting to get on the radio. Just after that, and so I got involved with CKLN. And then I brought Nelson back on, and he was part of our radio stuff. And I don't know if you heard them. You might. I could send you a link to us doing McLuhan on CKLN in November 84. We did an hour. We played our recordings and stuff. So we did a lot of McLuhan on CKLN. You know what I mean? And that was when nobody gave a damn.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that show.
Okay. And let's see. And then we got involved with Mary and Mrs. McLuhan, and it expanded. You know, we.
But Mary, was Mary in Toronto?
No. No, she'd been living in California since 65, 66.
Yeah. So how did you get involved with her?
Well, she would come back, and once we were involved with Mrs. McLuhan in the late 80s, Mary would come back, you know, once or twice a year, and I had met Mary in 76, so she knew me. Or no, 77, fall of 77 in California. She knew me, but I don't know what she knew of Nelson, but she heard about Nelson from her mother, so about 89, 90, she came back. And one day Nelson told me, because I just lived up the street from Wichita Park, told me to come down to the house because he was there. He wanted me to meet somebody. So I went down there, and there was Mary. And then I reminded Mary, you know, that who I was. And then she said, oh, yeah, yeah, I remember you, blah, blah, blah. So that started our thing, and we kind of started a center, a consulting thing. And Mary was giving out awards. She had the Teachers Award thing she was doing, been doing since early 80s.
The Marsha McLuhan Foundation.
Right, and we helped her with every new time she had to do something. We'd give her ideas. One time she called us up and said she was just with the Grateful Dead, and it was coming up to New Year's Eve, and they wanted to have some McLuhan stuff. I think that was the 89 going into 90, you know, a new decade. And so we quickly got Calva together from our archives, some video of McLuhan. It's actually the one from 74 down in Florida where he's saying rock means the end of literacy, the death of literacy. You know that speech?
Yeah, I think that a lecture at Florida State or something.
Yeah, and his hair is blowing in the wind. It's like oddly sticking up. And so he's so we sent that, we took that part, rock kills literacy. And so, you know, within a week we heard back from the Grateful Dead. They loved it, and they thought it was a really great quote. They loved playing it at their concert. So typical exploitation of McLuhan and avoiding the cul-de-sac. So that's what would happen. Mary knew everybody. George Lucas, Jerry Brown. We met a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
We went to the Oscars in 92 with Mary and met a lot of people there. And that went on for until 93. Then I went to New York. And then Nelson got busy doing something else, so Mary wasn't around from 95 to 2000. Then she came back, and then Nelson hooked up with her, and then I did. And then that's when I personally, since I was living in the States, started talking to her on the phone regularly and had more of a separate involvement with her that didn't include Nelson. Nelson would be involved with her, whatever they did, separately from me. So eventually Nelson got fed up with Mary or something, and he dropped her, and then it was just me and Mary left. And Mary was trying to get a McLuhan chair at Harvard or Stanford, so I was involved in talking to people about her efforts to get them to take McLuhan seriously and put a chair in. And she never, as far as I know, she never got it done. Never happened.
She would have. The key to that is money. You have to offer enough money.
Yeah, and she didn't have that.
Anybody would be happy to have the chair if it had the right amount of money.
Right, but they seem to be interested in having the name McLuhan because, you know, McLuhan was coming back into favor, and it looked like a lot of people wanted to help her, professors and that, and get it done, but nobody. Maybe because the universities were all falling apart anyways. Nobody really was doing anything anymore, so it didn't work. So that's why am I telling you that? Finnegan's Wake. We're talking about Finnegan's Wake, so, copies of Finnegan's Wake.
That's right. And that's a good place for me to tell you that I'm looking at the holdings now at the Fisher Library. And they have two copies there, not three. They do have the scribbled hovel, which is the first version of Finnegan's Wake, and they also have a first draft version of Finnegan's Wake, and all of these the first draft version is heavily annotated, like the two copies of Finnegan's Wake that they have.
Well, they say they're heavily. You don't see the annotations. They say they're heavily annotated, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I imagine. So, I think one of them had a lot of Eric stuff in it. Eric kept that.
That would be a problem, right? Trying to sift out Marshall and Eric.
No, you can tell the different writing styles.
Yeah, they have a different style. That's for sure. Yeah.
And Eric copied a lot of Marshall. You know, he basically was using Marshall's pattern for studying it. But he would find interesting things, and Marshall occasionally would compliment what Eric found that he didn't know about. But Don Thiel, when he read Eric's PhD, he says, I recognize a lot of that stuff from the card box. What would it be, Dorothy Candies or something? McLuhan had a lot of cards, index cards, in some kind of...
Laura Secord.
Yeah. Laura Secord thing, right? Laura Secord?
Yeah.
And he, Don and Marshall made those cards. And so Don recognized that Eric got a lot of his stuff from those cards because Don remembered them writing it out.
Yeah.
He could recognize it in the PhD.
Do you know where those cards are?
No. I don't even think I ever saw them. They weren't in the parts that I organized.
But that would be an important part of a McLuhan commentary on the wake.
Yeah. So, you know, have you ever seen Andrew's series of him going through and annotating Eric's library? Have you seen that series that Andrew has up?
I've only watched a couple of them.
Right, but you get to see the library, and that's Eric's library plus a lot of the McLuhan library that he had, that he kept.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you get to see what it is. You know, if you keep looking, Andrew shows you different parts of it, so you get to get a whiff.
There's another example, Bob. You got time to do everything except my blog.
That's right. I know all what you think. I talk to you every 2 weeks. You know, I know what you think.
Yeah.
No, but I do want to read more detail. So I'll get to it. As somebody used to say to me, when I get 5 minutes, Bob, in an English accent, when I get 5 minutes. But I have a lot of time to do a lot of things. You know, I only sleep 3.5 hours, so I can do a lot of stuff.
Yeah, good. Bob, we're at 7:30.
Okay, we got to end.
We should be thinking about wrapping it up. Do we want to identify just where we are? And
I think I'll make a statement.
Okay, fire away.
Yeah, we read the quote from Croker.
Right.
And my commentary on that, my conversational commentary in the blue script says, we don't have 5 senses anymore. We have 14 or 28. Consider every little app and device you put into your armamentarium, your reservoir of ammunition, is a collection of new senses because there are all kinds of bodies. Arthur Croker just talks about plural bodies. He doesn't get into the 5 types that I came up with. I put it in order. When he's talking about the body has no meaning today. He's writing about the chemical body, but you could project that he's describing the tech body. Then I say, hontology, in quotes, a concept invented by Jacques Derrida, explores the afterimage. My defining of the Android meme as an afterimage is supported by Croker's quotation. The second phase of the Android meme breaks up the mythic stages. It actually becomes more and more shrunken, homeopathic, cliche probes, or memes. So let me just go back up here. Before the Croker quote, I say, no, I don't. So after that, I get into the homeopathic. So that's where I wanted to get. So I'm going to pick up next time and continue the explanation of the homeopathic into the meme via the verbal module. Okay?
Yeah, that's comments that you're making here after the Croker quote they're worthy of a lot of explication.
Okay.
Put it that way.
All right.
So we'll get into that the next time. We'll get into what's behind, what's implicated by all this stuff here.
Yep. That's what we got to do.
Good. I'll look forward. I'll look forward to that, Bob.
Okay. Well, great talking to you once again, Cameron, and have a good 2 weeks.
Same here, Bob. Good. Look forward.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, how is your leg? Everything growing
good.
Properly?
Yeah, everything's coming together. I'm walking like 2-3 miles every day.
And, wow.
It's coming along.
That's good.
I'm hoping to begin jogging at some point.
Did you do that?
I can't jog yet.
But you couldn't jog before, right?
No. Definitely
so
not.
That would be like going back 10, 15 years to when you used to jog?
Well, not that long. But at least it would be going back 5 to 10 years. That's right.
Right. Wow. That would be incredible to get back to jogging. Okay,
that's
man.
Right.
Talk to you soon.
Good. Ciao, ciao, Bob.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.